Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And it looks like last week's bombshell testimony from President Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen was just the beginning. This morning, the House Judiciary Committee released a list of 81 people and entities in President Trump's circle that are being asked to provide documents and perhaps testify as the committee begins its own investigation of the president. Joining us now is NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing in Washington. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, who is on this list and what does the committee hope to learn from them?
Well, it's a very long list. If you can think of a name of a person or a company or an institution associated with Trump World or the stories that have become familiar since the 2016 campaign, it's on here. Let me just read off a couple. Both Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, and his son, Michael Flynn Jr., are on here. Steve Bannon, the former campaign boss for Donald Trump, the White House itself, the Trump campaign, the Trump Foundation, the Trump Organization, Columbus Nova, Concord Management, the Brad Parscale, the 2020 Trump campaign chairman, etc. It goes on and on and on. This is a very broad range of targets for the House Judiciary Committee chairman, Jerry Nadler of New York, and his colleagues, because they say they want to find out a lot of information.
And Donald Trump Jr., the president's son, is on here. So is Eric Trump, but not Ivanka Trump, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What is the committee hoping to learn specifically from the president's kids?
Well, they've decided they're going to cover three main areas, all of which kind of dovetail not only with the children, but these other targets, which are, they call, obstruction of justice, public corruption, and abuses of power. This is the designations that Nadler and his staff made in announcing these requests for information, whether or not the president and his family or others tried to hurt investigations by the government or Congress, whether the Trump family has been taking inappropriate remuneration or getting other rewards from people as part of their tenure in the White House in the Trump administration, and whether or not the president and his family have abused their authority, including in, I'm quoting here, attacks on the press, the judiciary, and law enforcement agencies, misuse of the pardon power, and other authorities. So these are very serious and very broad allegations or inquiries that Jerry Nadler and the Democrats are trying to get underway.
Another name on this list that people may have heard last week in the Michael Cohen testimony is Alan Weisselberg. This is the CFO of the Trump Organization. What are they hoping to learn from him?
Weisselberg was the paymaster and money man for Trump's organization before he became president. And according to Cohen's testimony before the House Oversight Committee, Weisselberg would have been part of arrangements Trump concluded with many people to try and buy embarrassing secrets about himself. Cohen arranged a payment through the publisher of the National Enquirer to one woman. Cohen made a payment himself to another woman. And as Cohen described, the Trump organization and partners like this publisher of the National Enquirer, the American Media Incorporated Company, would pay people for dirt, whether it was true or not, to keep it out of the public eye, to stop embarrassments. Weisselberg, according to Cohen, was at the center of those arrangements, and so he would know as much as anyone about them. And because he was involved as the CFO with the earnings of the Trump organization, he would know where the money came from and to whom it was paid, presumably.
Now, Phil, the word being used here is request, that this committee is requesting these documents. Does that mean that somebody could say, no, we're not going to give these to you?
That's right. And so far, we've heard this morning from the White House and the Justice Department. They've said to our correspondents, we've received these requests from Jerry Nadler. But the Oversight and Judiciary and Intelligence Committees have been making requests for a long time. Mm-hmm. What's different now is that Jerry Nadler is in the majority. So not only can he ask politely of these people to give testimony or information or provide documents, he does have the power eventually to try and compel them to do that through his subpoena power. Republicans, when they were in the majority, didn't want to go along with those types of requests because they felt the Democrats were being overbroad or their investigations were scurrilous or politically motivated. Now they're in the minority and they don't have the power to block those attempts. And what Nadler has indicated and what the other chairmen of these important committees have said is if they don't get what they want, they could use those subpoenas to try to force people to give these members the information that they're looking for.
Let's listen to Nadler on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday. He said he thinks that President Trump obstructed justice and abused his power, but he stopped short of calling for impeachment right now.
Impeachment is a long way down the road. We don't have the facts yet, but we're going to initiate proper investigations. The Republicans...
Impeachment investigations?
No.
Phil, just a few seconds here, but is that answer likely to change over time, or do you think the Democrats are going to stick with that? No, not impeachment.
That's the big question now. Can Nadler and Pelosi, the House Speaker, stay on this side of the line of impeachment, or will they discover something so damning about the president that they feel they have to go down that road? Because that's a big political question. Mm-hmm. It's going to tear the country apart if it happens, clearly.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, turning to Syria, ISIS is now down to its final foothold in that country, surrounded by the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces in Bahuz, a village in eastern Syria. Today, those fighters were said to be slowing their offensive because ISIS is reportedly using civilians as human shields. CNN senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann is just outside that village. He's been on the ground in Syria, in fact, for about a month. And he joins us now on his cell phone. Ben, thank you so much, first, for giving us some time.
My pleasure.
And first of all, tell us, we're hearing these reports of civilians being used as human shields, but then we're also hearing separately that aid groups were able to get most of the civilians out. So what's true there? Do you know?
Since the beginning of February, 15,000 at least people have left the area of Bahuz, which is the town that was under ISIS's control. What we saw just about half an hour ago was about 200 civilians who have managed to leave the town since this morning, and we were told that more than 800 have left on this day. And the situation in there is obviously dire. We were watching from a building overlooking the camp yesterday and saw that the bombardment was intense. There's no way to get any aid into there, and obviously, given that the area is controlled by ISIS, it's unlikely anybody would want to take aid into there. So the only people who get out, they get aid, but most of them are headed straight to what is known as El Hul camp, which is essentially an internment camp for people leaving the areas controlled by ISIS, internment because they're not trusted. Many of them who we've spoken to have said they remain loyal to the idea of the Islamic State, of the Islamic Caliphate.
Wow. I mean, you are right there. I mean, telling us that you're seeing civilians coming out of this town even today as we speak. And we've also been hearing reports that some ISIS fighters are actually hiding themselves in these groups of civilians coming out. So not quite sure who to trust at this moment. But you spoke to a commander of the Syrian Democratic Forces. Again, these are U.S.-backed troops, largely led by Kurdish fighters who have been fighting ISIS. Let's listen.
Some of them want to surrender. They're suicidal, and some want to escape, but we won't let them, says Safkan, the commander on this roof. They can either surrender or die.
And right now, as you say, Ben Wiedemann, there on the ground in Syria, ISIS is not surrendering. But a question for you. What happens to these Syrian Democratic Forces? These are largely the militia groups that, you know, the citizens that rose up during the uprising and then participated in the civil war, now, as we said, led by Kurds. It seems that the conclusion is that, you know, the U.S. troops will be largely pulling out. The Russian-backed Assad regime is, in essence, kind of winning this conflict. What happens to these troops who have been doing the dirty work of taking down ISIS?
Well, I think that's the question they're asking themselves at this point. Now, we understand the latest permutation of the Trump administration policy towards Syria is that 400 military personnel will remain in Syria, which is not the same as the approximately 2,000 who are here now. That may go some way to reassure the Kurds that perhaps the Americans will remain committed to them. because their immediate worry is, of course, that Turkey, which considers the Kurdish element within the Syrian Democratic Forces to be a terrorist organization, and then, therefore the Turks have made it clear they will somehow manage to set up a buffer zone, a safe zone, a security zone along the border, and they will do their best to undermine the forces that the United States has spent several years now arming and training and building up. So, and then there's the other worry, of course, is that the Assad regime wants to reassert its authority in this part of Syria, which is independent from the regime in Damascus.
Yeah. Well, and Ben, one last question as you do your work there in Syria. It seems that this ISIS group in this one small town, Bahuz, is going to be taken down. But is there a sense that that's the end of ISIS?
No, no, of course not. The conclusion of anybody at all familiar with reality on the ground is that ISIS, as a terrorist insurgency, has many years yet to go.
CNN senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann, on the ground in eastern Syria, outside the town, which is the last that's being held by ISIS there. Ben, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And for opening this window into that part of the world.
When President Trump called for an end to HIV/AIDS in his State of the Union address, he didn't mention one of the most effective tools being used to do that. It's called PrEP, and it's a drug that people can take to prevent contracting HIV. In the U.S., the drug name is Truvada, made by Gilead Sciences. And our next guest wants the National Institutes of Health to break the patent on Truvada so it will be cheaper. He's Corey Johnson, the Speaker of the New York City Council, and he is HIV positive himself. Corey Johnson, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what is the case that you and others are making for why the government should and would legally be able to break the patent that exists on Truvada?
Well, for folks that don't know, Truvada, which is otherwise commonly referred to as PrEP, is an important medicine that helps prevent people from getting HIV. And I'm one of a few, I think there's only six of us in the entire country, openly HIV positive elected officials. And so there has been a coalition of activists who have been advocating for breaking this patent that Gilead has right now, the company that has manufactured PrEP, and saying that the NIH should march in, which is a technical term, and actually break the patent. And the case that's being made is that this was publicly funded research by the NIH, and in other countries around the world, Truvada costs about $100 a year for a patient. In the United States, it's almost $20,000 a year for the same exact medicine. And Truvada prevents HIV almost up to 99% of the time. And so the case we're making is that given that American taxpayers and the NIH have funded this research, the patent should be broken so that more people can get access to it to prevent anyone from becoming HIV positive.
Is there precedent that you're looking to where the NIH has done this in the past for another drug?
Sadly, no. The NIH has the ability to do this. They have never before used their march-in rights. And the march-in rights come from a law passed by Congress called the Bayh-Dole Act in 1980, which allows these patents to be broken in certain cases that involve research that resulted from federal funds. Given how broken I believe our healthcare system is nationally, I'm not entirely optimistic, but there's a first time for everything. And I think in this instance, it's important. President Trump, I don't think he's done much for the LGBT community, but he did say in his State of the Union address a couple of weeks ago that he wanted to end the AIDS epidemic in the United States of America, and this could be a good way to start down that path.
Why is there a cheaper version available in other countries but not here?
Because in other countries, where the healthcare system is different and where big pharmaceutical companies aren't able to inflate the cost of drugs, people can get this at an affordable price or generic versions of the drug. In the United States, the U.S. government doesn't regulate the prices of these drugs and bring them down to what the cost is, which is why you see Americans, whether they're someone that has diabetes or needs to take PrEP or has cancer, the price of the medication they need could be wildly expensive. And that's why I think we need to break the patent in this instance.
You've noted that only 8% of the people who should be using PrEP in the United States to prevent HIV are using it. Is that because of cost or lack of access or lack of awareness or what?
I think it's all of those things. I don't think cost is the only factor. Most of that 8% of folks who are using it are white, gay or bisexual men. And some of the highest infection rates that we're seeing now are women, women of color, men who have sex with men who are people of color, African Americans and Latinos, transgender Americans, IV drug users. And so you have barriers to access coupled with the cost and coupled with other healthcare factors that certain populations deal with every single day.
The rate of HIV transmission in New York City was at an all-time low in 2017. How much of that do you think is related to people taking Truvada?
I think PrEP is an important variable in that number. One of the things I'm really proud of is before I was Speaker of the Council, I was chair of the Health Committee in the City Council. And over the last 6 years, we've gotten New York City and New York State both to put in tens of millions of new dollars on preventing people from being infected. That just hasn't included greater access to Truvada and to PrEP. It's included a whole host of things in making sure that people who currently are HIV positive remain undetectable so they can't pass along HIV to anyone else. The number that you cited, it shows the lowest infection rate from 2 years ago that's ever been recorded since the start of the epidemic. We know what to do to prevent people from getting HIV.
What has the drug maker Gilead said to you about your idea?
Well, Gilead, of course, has been resistant to this. They have said that they have discount programs. They help people who don't currently have insurance or have insurance that may not cover it to be able to get it at a more affordable rate. And that's well and good for certain people, but that doesn't open up the doors and the windows for access to all of the folks that really, really need it. Just for me, this is personal. You know, I seroconverted when I was 22 years old. I'm 36 years old now, and I lost my health insurance afterwards. Truvada and PrEP was not around. And I feel like I'm doing this and all the activists are doing this really on the shoulders of all of those that came before us. People who are part of ACT UP and Queer Nation, people that shut down the New York Stock Exchange in the 1980s and 1990s and marched and put their lives and bodies on the line at the height of the AIDS epidemic. AIDS isn't on the front page of newspapers anymore, but it is still an epidemic in the United States.
What is it like right now for you? I've seen you described as the most high-profile HIV-positive politician in the country. What is it like to be in that position right now?
You know, it's really kind of crazy because in 2004, as I said, when I found out I was HIV positive, I was despondent. I was depressed. I was ashamed. I wasn't sure I could ever talk about this. And to go from that moment as a scared and vulnerable and isolated 22-year-old to now being the Speaker of the New York City Council and one of the highest-ranking elected officials in the country who is openly HIV positive, it's sort of amazing, my own journey. And at the same time, I see it as a real responsibility to fight for others who may not have this position of influence to ensure that everyone gets access to the care that they need need. And we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of Stonewall in June of this year. And I feel like so much of my ability to run for office and to be Speaker of the City Council and to do it as an openly gay, openly HIV positive man is really because of all of the activists that came before me, many people who I don't know. And so I really do this on their shoulders and in their names, continuing to fight for LGBT people and vulnerable people, as all of the activists did before I ever even realized I was gay, which allowed me to run for office and be in this position today.
We've been talking about the pharmaceutical aspect of fighting HIV/AIDS. What about the stigma issue? How big of an issue is that in preventing the nation, the world, from ending, eliminating HIV and AIDS?
Well, it's clearly a big issue, but also there are some, I guess, interesting things that we know now because of Truvada and PrEP, which is if you're on Truvada and PrEP, again, you 99% chance you're not going to become infected. And if you're someone who's HIV positive like myself and who takes medicine every single day, I'm what's called undetectable, which means I can't transmit HIV to another person. Because of those two things, it has become easier for folks to actually talk about being HIV positive. The vast majority, not all, but many, many of the new infections that occur are people that don't know they're HIV positive. They don't know what their status is because they haven't gotten tested. And then because they don't know it, they end up transmitting HIV to someone else. And so it's really, really important to talk about HIV, talk about being HIV positive yourself. You know, again, I couldn't have imagined that 15 years ago when I found out that I was HIV positive, that I would be on a radio show talking about my status. And it shows the importance of breaking down the stigma so that there isn't shame and fear associated with this, because that's what contributes to this epidemic. And it's what has contributed to the epidemic from the very early days of it.
I want to ask you one more thing. You mentioned President Trump, and he called in the State of the Union for an end to HIV in 10 years. What do you think about that, and do you have any faith that this effort will work?
I mean, it was interesting to watch the State of the Union and to hear him say those words, because over the last 2 years, his administration has been one that has sought to cut funding at the federal level for all sorts of medical research. A lot of the folks that he's appointed to key positions in his administration are vocal opponents of LGBT rights and people. And so it was nice to hear it, but words, I guess, don't really matter at this point. It's really about actually actions and doing the right thing. And I think those of us who work on these issues would really love to see leadership at the federal level, but I'm really skeptical at this point.
That is Corey Johnson, who is the Speaker of the New York City Council. Speaker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And your thoughts welcome at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
I guess it was only a matter of time, but it is now official. The market research company eMarketer reports that this year, U.S. digital advertising spending will surpass traditional ad spending for the first time. Joining us now with the details is Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the basics. What is digital advertising versus traditional advertising?
Okay, so digital ads appear on platforms that include desktop, laptop computer, tablets, search engines, mobile devices, social media. Traditional ads are the ones that everybody knows, newspaper, radio, television, magazines, billboards.
And what kind of money are we talking about here?
Okay, so the projection is that digital ad spending will rise to $130 billion this year. That's a 19% increase, while traditional ad spending will fall 11% to $110 billion. It'll surprise no one that about two-thirds of the digital ads will appear on mobile devices, since people spend an average of 4 hours a day on their smartphones.
And they're getting so much better at targeting people in those mobile ads. We know that Facebook and Google get almost 60% of digital ad spending right now. Who else?
So Google gets about 37%, Facebook about 22%. Amazon is coming on strong. They're projected to get about 9% this year of digital ad spending, and perhaps double that in 3 years. It's not surprising there because nearly 50% of U.S. e-commerce sales happen on Amazon, and about half of product searches begin there.
And all of this reflects a dramatic shift of audiences toward these digital platforms.
Right. You know, people are shifting to digital in big numbers. Take the New York Times, for instance. They've got 4.3 million subscribers. 3.3 million of them are digital. So advertisers want to fish where the fishes are. Digital ad revenue for the Times is now 46% of overall ad revenue. It's probably just going to keep growing while print advertising falls. It's down about 10% in the fourth quarter last year.
And is it safe to assume that this kind of growth in digital ad dollars will occur across the board?
Absolutely. The projection is by 2021, digital ad revenue will grow to $172 billion. That's versus the $130 billion this year. Traditional ad revenue will fall to $104 billion from $110 billion this year. By 2023, they're saying digital ads will constitute more than two-thirds of all ad spending.
And when there's this much money being spent, of course, there is the thought that it should be taxed. And there's a group that just said that that's exactly what should happen. There should be a tax on digital ad spending.
Right. This group, Free Press, proposes a tax on targeted advertising. They say, think of it like a carbon tax. This would basically go out, put a 2% tax on digital advertising, and they would dedicate it to fund diverse local, independent, and non-commercial journalism.
So is there any chance something like that could pass?
Yeah, right about when the carbon tax passes.
John, the industry is changing so quickly right now. You teach a lot of students about this kind of thing. What do you even do when you're teaching them how to do advertising in 2019?
Well, part of the trick with advertising now is how do you package it? So the less it looks like advertising in many ways, the more effective it is. So advertisers are looking for alternatives. They'll still do the banner ads. They'll still do the pop-up ads. But a lot of them are looking more toward branded content, which is basically providing something that looks like editorial,
right.
But it's marketing material.
Fool people.
Right.
John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now. And we've got a link to his blog at hereandnow.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
And here's a stat for you. In 2017, Americans spent about $19 million on gym memberships, but according to at least one study, over half of them never went. Now, maybe that's you. Maybe the gym's too far, or the hours don't work with your schedule, or you can't find socks that match. Look, you might want to consider a fitness app. After all, there are only about 320,000 of them. Before you panic, fitness and travel writer Peter Cook has tried them, so you don't have to. His article, The Best Fitness Apps for 2019, appeared in a recent issue of GearPatrol.com. We'll link you. Well, we welcome Peter. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You say what a lot of people say about apps in general, that our smartphones are pretty much killing us. They disrupt our sleep, destroy our cognitive resources. They give us bent backs and kinked necks. They make us depressed and anxious and isolated. Why should we turn to an app as opposed to going to a gym?
Sure. Well, you know, the facts are, like you said, that 67% of people aren't even using their gym memberships. Mm-hmm. And this offers sort of a convenient way that's literally in your pocket. And many of them are coaching you through it, so you don't have to hire a private coach. So it's cost effective that way.
Okay, so those are good reasons. So let's start ticking through some of what you think are the best apps.
Sure.
What is app? Is it, how do you say it?
Aptive. It's one of these ones that allows you to do multiple things. Stretching classes, yoga classes, boxing, weightlifting, guided workouts in your ears. There's nothing to look at, which is convenient. One of the caveats of these fitness apps is that it can be tricky to look at your right. phone while you're doing it. And these ones just talk right in your ear and guide you through whatever it is you're after.
So let's listen to a little.
Hey, guys and girls, it's Jamie here at Aptiv. Right now, I want you clearing your mind of anything that is not this spin class.
three, two, here we go. Push it.
So that's Aptiv. We'll have this listed at herenow.org. What about Nike plus Run Club?
What I really like about this app is that it goes beyond what so many running apps do, which is simply tracking and logging your runs with GPS. And it goes as far as providing audio-guided runs for new runners, as well as free personalized coaching plans for those who want to take the running to the next level. I'm a runner myself since high school, and the one thing I see among inexperienced runners is that they tend to go out and run roughly the same distance at roughly the same pace every time. So it's easy to understand why their fitness might plateau or they might lose interest over time. By giving you these plans to follow that, you know, they'll include lots of slow, easy running that most of us are already doing, but also punches in those strenuous efforts that will result in huge fitness and strength and speed gains.
Some of the coaches are athletes.
Yeah, indeed. Many of them are Olympic caliber athletes like Shalane Flanagan and Chris Derrick.
And so you can feel like you're running with them.
And I am Nike Plus Run Club coach Jess Woods.
We're going to take you through a warm-up and provide a speed workout that you can do anywhere. We know you might want to skip the warm-up, but please don't. The warm-up is crucial.
Very cool. Tell us about Swerkit, because we're hearing more and more that no matter how long a workout, it's worth it. They're talking about workout as snacks. Treat a set of stairs in the afternoon like a snack break and go up and down it, and it does have a good effect, even though it may only be a few minutes. We understand Swerkit will give you, you know, a 10-minute, 7-minute, 6-minute workout.
Yeah, strength, cardio, yoga, and it'll be a video-guided, precision-timed, sports scientist-approved workout.
No matter the time.
No matter the time.
Let's move on to Asana Rebel. I'm guessing this is a yoga app, and you will see a teacher doing the poses?
Correct. The reason I chose Asana Rebel was Gear Patrol is a men's lifestyle publication, and guys in particular seem to have trouble getting past the outdated and frankly incorrect idea that yoga's for girls.
Yeah, no kidding.
So they spice up yoga's image by combining traditional yoga practices like vinyasa and ashtanga with relatable strength exercises like burpees, mountain climbers, and planks.
Well, and you can get that in a lot of yoga classes, so maybe someone will transition. What's Fitbot, one of your picks? It's now called True Coach. It's for weightlifters?
Yeah.
Casey and I developed Fitbot to help personal trainers and strength coaches save time.
It uses AI or artificial intelligence to help you plan your gym sessions based on your goals. So every time you hit the weights, it's not only guiding you step by step through each exercise, including the weight, number of sets, and reps, but it also takes your performance from that day and uses it to tweak your plan going forward for upcoming sessions.
This brings us to apps that get to know you. I'm looking at Kilo. They actually are smart programs, a lot of them, so they adjust along with you.
Yeah, that's a huge aspect of these newer training apps is that they use this artificial intelligence. You know, they learn from what you're doing. Kilo, that's a HIIT training program based on high-intensity interval training, and it basically looks at your recent history as doing these workouts on the app, and it'll tweak each workout going forward based on what you've done so to make sure you're getting well-rounded fitness by hitting parts of the body that you've been basically ignoring.
Yeah. So again, some of these apps using AI, Fitbot does this too. They learn from your workouts and they adjust accordingly to try to get you to a higher level, which seems like it might keep you from going too far too fast. You also talk about an app, NEOU, which has live streaming, on-demand workouts. What, trainers at New York facilities film their routines?
Yeah, live streaming workouts is definitely one of the biggest fitness trends from 2018, and that's going to continue this year. Most people have heard of Peloton bikes by now,
right.
And what all of these various apps that have live streaming will do is they catalog all of those for on-demand, which just means if you liked that workout, you know, yesterday, then you can take it with you and do it 3 days later.
So let's listen to a little.
How are you doing at home?
You guys have tuned in for a 30-minute boxing session.
Are you guys ready?
All sorts of group fitness classes like HIIT classes, boot camps, boxing, core strength, mobility classes, dance, everything.
You include in the apps, the workout apps, a sleep app?
Yeah, my thought there is that what most people, at least the people who really start to get into exercise, like you can get hooked on it, pressing more fitness into your already busy schedule, so you're just going to wake up early, bang through a workout at 5 a.m., and, you know, sleep is super important to coming back and having a stronger, better workout the next day.
So Sleep Cycle will use your phone's accelerometer to monitor and record your movement and quality of sleep. A couple other apps you recommend, 8Fit. You outsource all your fitness and nutrition planning as you get a personal trainer and a nutritionist. It customizes meal plans and exercise based on what you tell it, you know, your goal is. That could be $60 a year. And then Charity Miles. Tell us about that.
Well, Charity Miles is as simple as it sounds. I guess it's looking for altruism as a motivator for exercise. It's basically just a GPS tracking device that you can use to track your walking, your running, your cycling. For every mile you run, you can earn money for a charity of your choice. It's up to 25 cents per mile for running and walking, and up to 10 cents per mile for cycling.
Very cool. So, Peter Cook, after this adventure you've had of going deep into all these fitness apps, what's your takeaway? I mean, you started off by saying we're not supposed to isolate ourselves with our iPhones. They're not supposed to be good for us. But...
Well, I think that the most important thing about making any fitness routine work, including these apps, which I do find very useful, especially if you're someone who's not super familiar with fitness modalities and doesn't really know how to self-guide their exercise. But what's very important to make them work for you is to do a realistic self-assessment beforehand so you know what motivates you, if that's group fitness, if that's running, if that's cycling, if that's yoga. So knowing that and then being realistic about the time that you are going to set aside. When it comes to the money, the average health club price, believe it or not, is $50 a month. So that's $600 a year. And these apps, it's usually much, much lower than that. And if you can stick to it, if you're honest about your fitness assessment, then I think that you can make them work.
Fitness writer Peter Cook, his recent article on the best new fitness apps of 2019 is in gearpatrol.com. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Peter, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
HBO's controversial new documentary about allegations of sexual abuse by Michael Jackson wraps up tonight. The first part of Leaving Neverland debuted last night. It tells the story of two men, James Safechuck and Wade Robson, who claims Jackson abused them when they were boys. Here's Robson.
He was one of the kindest, most gentle, loving, caring people I knew. He helped me tremendously. He helped me with my career. He helped me with my creativity, with all of those sorts of things. And he also sexually abused me for 7 years.
The Jackson family is denying the allegations. Let's bring in Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and a warning that this conversation may not be appropriate for all listeners. Derek, I watched the documentary last night. You say you watched it through gritted teeth. Give us a sense of what was uncovered.
Yeah, I'll offer a brief summary. The documentary focuses on the experience of these two young men, Safechuck and Robson. Both were child stars in their own way. James was a model actor and Wade was a young dancer. And they describe in brutally intimate detail how Michael Jackson first reached out to them, befriended their families, and then seemingly groomed them for years of sexual abuse. And most of this episode, the first of two episodes airing on HBO, focuses in really excruciating detail just how Jackson sexually abused them. And to me, what made the episode so visceral isn't just those brutal details, but also how the testimonies rhyme. Both of the men say Jackson threatened them to stay quiet about the abuse, saying to one, I believe, that if the details were uncovered, they would both go to jail forever. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, both say they loved him, that their abuse was wrapped up in an emotional relationship, and that this kind of forthrightness, I think, to me, about how those feelings of love were interlaced with these really horrifying details of abuse made it, I thought, a really utterly heartbreaking abuse survivor story.
And to that point, the fact that what they say in this documentary, at least last night, is that the things that Jackson would do to them were basically the same with each boy.
That's right. That's right. And we don't need to go into the details here because they are really, really excruciating. But that's to me what made it so effective as a piece of legal review. It's unbelievably emotional, and the appeal of any accusation like this against one of the most famous musicians of all time, certainly the 20th century, is going to be a lightning bolt. But really, to me, the authenticity of what they said, the verisimilitude, really came from the rhyming testimonies, the fact that they seemed to be describing an experience that was a kind of blueprint on Michael Jackson's part for grooming young boys.
Well, one of the things that James Safechuck, one of the men, said in the documentary is that Jackson went so far as to buy him a wedding ring. Let's listen.
I was really into jewelry, and he would reward me with jewelry for doing sexual acts for him. He would say that I need to sell him some so that I can earn the gift.
Derek, are these new detailed claims enough, do you think, to change the public's view of Jackson? And by that I mean, are people going to feel uncomfortable even listening to his music now?
Yeah, I did my best to comb through several sites and social media platforms to gauge the reaction to the documentary. And I would say the overall reaction was abject horror and shame among some Michael Jackson fans, among many Michael Jackson fans, saying, I can't believe that I still listen to his music. I can't believe this man still has statues and accolades and radio play. On a personal note, for me, there are a lot of instances where I separate the artist from the art. I like Picasso's art tremendously, even though he was a jerk. I think Charles Dickens was a genius whose books I really adored, even though he tried to have his wife locked up when he decided to leave her. So I do make this separation on a daily basis, but I don't know how I could listen to Michael Jackson right now. I don't know how I could hear Michael Jackson in a store, in an office, in a public space, and not immediately think of these accusations and these stories.
The Jackson estate is denying these allegations and is suing HBO, actually, for $100 million. What is the family saying about this documentary, and what's at stake for them?
So Michael Jackson's estate still makes a tremendous amount of money. According to Forbes, Michael Jackson has made $2.1 billion adjusted for inflation in the few years since his death. That's billion with a B. And to be clear, even though these testimonies in the documentary are unbelievably emotional and ring true to me, it should be said that both of these young men have given sworn testimony at different times in their life, each denying that abuse had taken place. Robeson, when he was a younger boy, was the first witness called by Jackson's defense team in a 2005 criminal trial on molestation charges, according to the New York Times. Members of the families have said they don't have any corroborating evidence in terms of physical evidence on their hands, and none is presented in the documentary itself. So, you know, all of this, I think, goes to show that these are unbelievably dramatic testimonies in and of themselves. But from a legal standpoint, it's not clear exactly how it would play out in court.
And part two airs tonight. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.